first of all, just in case you're all worried about understanding these concepts of like ion channels and Nernst equation, all those good things. Why is this not? Oh, there it goes. Just want to show you this email I got the other day, a text actually, from a former student here. I won't mention the students. What does it say? I'll read it to you. Hey, Dr. Cooper, just wanted to check in and let you know that having had you for physiology is saving my tail end in medical school. Thanks for all that you've taught me. But anyways, she was a 350 student before, and the point is that they really don't spend time going through the Nernst equation, going through the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation that we're going to cover, and they kind of assume that you're getting all that as an undergraduate, all right? And they're moving along pretty quick. Right, and so to understand these concepts and to really dig into them, and having the 350 labs really helps quite a bit for your professional program later on, too. So we left off, and I know it was a little bit fast, talking about this, and I know in the back when we just projected the textbook, it was a little hard to see. But before we begin with this, what was neat in science yesterday? Anybody have something they want to share? You're going to get it? Questions every time? Yes, back there. Neat. So they exist probably around the same time? And
right.
Yeah, very cool. Isn't that cool? So many cool things out there. He saved you from the hat draw from the Hunger Games. All right. Other things that were really quite interesting, and I tried to get you going on things, just to, you know, think. You can always go to these journals and look up what are the highlights like last year, and they'll always give you some of the really neat things like cancer research, molecular human genetics. Here's some stuff in molecular medicine, immunology. Let's see what this one is. More immunology, highlights of neuroscience. The most downloaded articles in neuroscience last year. And just look at some of these. These are really quite cool. Immune abnormalities, autism, marijuana addiction, brain. They even came out with a new article about how it's affecting fetal development. You know, some people say, oh, it doesn't have any effects. But mothers that are using it while they're pregnant, now they know the effects on the fetus. So that's kind of interesting, too. Fluoride toxicity. A lot to go on with gut microbiota. Right. If you're taking a microbiology course, I really encourage you to take a micro course if you have a chance, or if you're graduating in May and you don't know what to do with yourself, come back and take some more classes. Micro is a really good one. We'll talk more about that when we get into the GI system. But there's so many neat things out there that are being discovered, like even the shark teeth that this gentleman mentioned. But we'll cover a little bit more of that as we go along. All right. And we're going to come back to some of these topics in just a minute. I don't know if you saw this. This just came out the other day. This is really cool. They've now imaged the fly brain, Drosophila adult fly brain, and it shows you what they're doing here. Let me get rid of that. All those little balls are actually synapses where communication's taking place in the fly brain. Billion synapses. Yikes. So the point here is you think about what they're doing with technology and what they can do now, speed things up with imaging. And there's an imaging course taught at UK too. Doug Harrison teaches it. So you might be interested in that. That's a course here that you can take as well, and they teach about using confocal microscopy as well as various light microscopy techniques and staining techniques. but it really gets you into some of the details. And to be able to do something like that, you think, oh, fruit fly brain, who cares, right? Why would we care? Back to class number one.
You could do the same with a human brain, or you could draw conclusions from the fly brain that would most likely work similar to other species.
Right. Exactly. So you can draw parallels with other species, maybe even the human brain. They are being able to image deeper and deeper into, like, mice brains. The problem is, I mean, what's nice here is you can actually image through that fly brain because it's not very thick. And the way you stain it up, you can actually image through that tissue. And now, I mean, there's a lot of slices going on, like the human brain at UC San Diego. They actually took a human brain and did very thin slices, right? You might have seen that on a YouTube connection. And they even did that with the whole human body, which is really cool. But then they could go in and start to mark each of the tracks and try to follow those tracks. But it's just, they can't, you know, do it all. It's just way too complicated. So the fly brain has really opened up quite a bit. There's about 60 human diseases modeled in Drosophila. Everything from diabetes to neurological problems to neuromuscular problems to the email I just sent you last night, or was it this morning? I can't remember. It was on your Canvas about ion channel pathologies, like night blindness, what happens with the calcium channel. So did anybody open up your Canvas yet or check that out? No? Yes? Maybe? Too much happening? Got other classes? I can't imagine. But anyways, if you look at that, when we're talking about ion channel pathologies, look at the Canvas site. You might see something later on, as I hinted in that email. And then look, open that up and maybe pick your favorite channel pathology. There are so many neat channel pathologies that are there. And like what we were just talking about, what was really interesting this last year, a lot of autoimmune diseases. Anybody read Brain on Fire? Brain on Fire? Anybody hear of that Brain on Fire? Yes? No? Maybe? Did you see the movie? They have it out on Netflix. The movie's kind of like, not so great. The book, Brain on Fire. Do you want to be interested in something outside of, you know, just your classes? When you go to your interviews or professional programs, say, oh, this really attracted me. This is why I want to be interested in this. This was another, you know, side reading that really got me interested. Brain on Fire. You should get the book. Read it, you know, over the break, winter. I mean, summer break that's coming up. This is spring, yes. and or maybe over some other break you have, spring break. And it's really good. So this, just to give you some prelude to it, the science writer, and I forget which magazine or newspaper she was writing for in New York, she had psychiatric problems. I mean, she was really just kind of, you know, not knowing what was going on. The movie kind of dramatized it a lot, but she was saying that she kind of felt like something's not right. And then her colleagues noticed that she really was acting quite weird. And the family thought she was really acting quite weird. So finally she went to a psychologist and they basically told her, you're, you know, crazy, right? And they're probably going to have to institutionalize her. Then this one person realized she doesn't really fit the classification of schizophrenia. It's not, all these little check marks aren't working. But she went to two different psychologists, psychiatrists, physicians, MDs that are studying psychology. Not psychologists, but psychiatrists, right? And they basically told her she was crazy. And then finally, they went to this one person and said, she doesn't really follow this category. So she's not really falling into the schizophrenic category. Maybe there's something else going on. What's so neat, which they didn't cover in the book, is that they went to this guy that was really studying research as well as psychiatric disorders. And he was the one in Pittsburgh, I think it was Pittsburgh or Pennsylvania, I forget which school, but he said, okay, let's look at her. She might have this other disorder that was just kind of classified recently. So they took the rat brain, did slices out of the rat brain, and took a sample of her brain. They didn't really want to do it, but she, you know, it's a way to really be sure about it. So they took a little tissue sample out of her brain, put in the slides together with the rodent brain, stained it up, and found out that she was developing antibodies to her NMDA receptors, a glutamate receptor in her brain. She had an autoimmune disease. Wow. But that was a classification. What really shows you is that comparative nature, too, in utilizing the rodent brain to stain it together. They did plasmapheresis, got out the antibodies that she was making, cleared up everything. How many people have been institutionalized that had the same disorder. That's phenomenal. So that was a required reading in the physical therapy program here. My daughter went to the physical therapy, and she brought home that book about, I don't know, 3 years ago or so. She said, "Dad, this is really interesting. You'd like to read it." She brings it home with, you know, at 6 o'clock, bad girl. And because then I start reading it, I can't put it down. You know, you're reading it all the way to midnight. It's just so exciting, right? And then you got to look up stuff and information. But really quite neat. So when you think about it, that's amazing. But when she wrote this book, she decided she needed to write this book up because it was misdiagnosed, for one thing, by the professional field. And then she wrote this book in layman's terms. And then at the end of the book, it's phenomenal. But I'll give it away because maybe you don't have time to read it. Somebody else went to the ER with their child and said to the physician, "I really think this person, my daughter, I think it was another daughter, has this problem." And the physician, no, doesn't have it. That's too rare. "Well, would you please check on this and just see if it was the case?" So the parent pushed for it. And yes, they had that problem. Since that book came out, they've been diagnosing these other people with psychiatric disorders over and over again. And now they're finding out that it's not that rare, and they're finding other disorders with autoimmune diseases. But you think about how many people are just locked away and never really treated right, and now she's living a normal life back again. So pretty amazing. Brain on Fire. Get the book. It's really cool. But when you think about that, look at the ion channel pathologies that I sent you in that book. How important do you think ion channels are to your development? And you think of the fly brain, this is why I bring it up, it's not a totally tangent, right? You can make that mutation that mimics the human mutation, right? In a sodium channel, in a calcium channel. How does it alter neural development, right? What about if you induce that problem later in life, for example? Now you give that fly, you have it maybe make these antibodies, or you express a knockdown in that fly as an adult. You can do that. You can look at it at different developmental periods, and you can see how it alters that function. Can it compensate? Could you use gene therapy, correct that gene mutation, for example? See all the powers that you can do very quickly with Drosophila. It takes a long time with rodent models and much more expensive, but you can ask these fundamental questions and understand, say, neuromuscular transmission disorders, things like that. So I know I'm preaching to the choir because you're all scientists, but I'm trying to make you see that segue by understanding comparative natures and appreciation of even a simple fruit fly, because they've offered so many aspects. Your immune system, for example. Wasn't that long ago that the three people got the Nobel Prize for understanding how anybody, if you're taking microbiology, the bacteria, gram-negative bacteria, releases these endotoxins called like lipopolysaccharides, and that gives you your immune response. Immunology is a great course to take here, and virology is another great course to take. And you get credit as biology students. That how your immune system is triggered, which can cause you to die, right? There's about 1.5 million people every year in the U.S. put in with septicemia, and I think it's about 250,000 around die every year of septicemia as well in the U.S. And you think it's pretty bad. That's blood bacterial infection in your blood. But to understand how that happens, like those immune responses that happen, actually they didn't understand how your body, how those immune cells start to release these cytokines that can really harm you. They discovered that receptor in Drosophila. And then they looked for it in mammals and rodents. And then they found out that's the receptor that's activating your immune system. So if we can block that, we can block the cytokine storm from being activated, right? And then they discovered a whole bunch of things. So they made these knockdowns in mice, and if you knock that down, then the mice gets very, you know, different kind of responses. It's an amazing aspect, what's out there. So just keep motivated. That's what I'm trying to motivate you, right? Really exciting. But you think about those breakthroughs really happened with a lot of simpler organisms like the fly. We wouldn't understand our immune response and how we're responding to these gram-negative bacterial endotoxins if it wasn't for that research that was really done in the Drosophila system. It's probably going to save lots of lives in the future. Okay, so we left off talking about this great equation right here. I don't know why that's up there. Why is that up there? Okay. This great equation, which is called the what? The Nernst equation. And if you're looking for a tattoo, This is a great tattoo to get. Okay. So what does the EM stand for? The potential, right? The electrical potential that exists due to a concentration gradient of ions across a membrane. The key here is that this is has to, what's not in this equation is that the membrane has to be permeable, right? And so this is kind of interesting too. So we're going to talk more about that as we go along. R, gas constant, T is in temperature in Kelvin, Z is the charge of the ion, F is the Faraday's constant. So R and T, you know, are constants, right? And then you can control for T, controlling your temperature, and Z, ion charge. Okay, so LN is kind of hard to work with. And you're going to be doing this in your lab next week, so this is why we wanted to go over this. So you can convert that LN to log, and I think it's, 2.3-something. I think it's in your textbook up here somewhere, I think. Yes. Well, it's in your textbook, and in your text, it actually mentions for different temperatures. So let's just do this. If you put in the temperature for 18 degrees C, and you convert ln to log, then that was, 0.58. And that's in volts, okay? And then you can have a log of whatever it is that you're looking at, of whatever the ion is. And the ions are usually like outside of the cell versus the inside of the cell, okay? So let's put in some terms that the textbook has here. If you used sodium, I think on page 131 in this textbook, they're using 120 millimolar on the outside and about 10 on the inside. And some of the problems that you might work in other textbooks or others, they might not tell you the temperature, so you have to worry about the temperature. If you go to 38 degrees, let's just put this in, like body temperature. They used 18 initially because that was looking at like the squid axon. If you go to 38 degrees, let's see what the calculation would be, 0.061, all right, instead of the 0.58. That's just to make the point is that it's temperature dependent in that aspect. But if you do this and you calculate this out, then you come up with, and this is for sodium ions, so it's a plus one charge. Let's see, what did they come up with? They came up with around 63 millivolts. Okay, or you can also, 0.063 if you're doing that. Remember, it's converted from volts to millivolts. So what does that mean? What does that mean? And I think this is where the textbook kind of drops the point a little bit about what does this mean. This is the equilibrium potential. Use the term as the equilibrium potential for that ion. Okay, so the equilibrium potential for that ion. So if you have this concentration gradient on the outside and the inside, you will generate this potential across the membrane. All right, are we all good with that? But what does that mean? What does that equilibrium potential mean? That means at that potential, there is no driving gradient either. Right? That's where it's reached an equilibrium. And I think it's a little confusing sometimes by just going through this type of experiment without putting it in some context of how they did this experiment. Now, this is not in your textbook. I'm not testing you on all the details, but I want you to understand how experimentally this came about, a little divergent, but I think it will really cement it into your brain a lot easier in understanding. So experimentally, they used what's called current voltage plots. And they did this with the squid axon. Okay, so the y-axis is current, the x-axis is potential, okay, membrane potential. Inward current, by definition, is downward. Outward current is upward. Okay, and this is some negative value over here, all right? So what they do is to take a cell, or the squid axon, and they put an electrode in there, or the squid axon, you can have the wire down the middle, and you step the potential up and you hold it at a particular value. So there's a ground wire on the outside, right? And it goes to some amplifier. Okay. And what they'll do is to step this up from, let's say, at the resting membrane potential. Maybe we'll step it up to, let's say that's around minus 60. Now we're going to step it up to minus 50. And we're going to see what kind of current flows across the membrane. And then we're going to step it up to another step. We're going to step it up to minus 40. You get the idea? And we're going to see what kind of current flows across the membrane. And we're going to step it up even higher, maybe to 0 millivolts, okay? Or even higher. Let's go to like plus 20. And you hold the membrane, and then you measure what kind of current flows across that membrane. So this is the experimental design. But what's the problem with this? And I know we didn't get into all the little details yet, so we're kind of jumping ahead. That's all the different types of channels that are there, right? So maybe you're getting current from calcium channels, sodium channels, potassium channels, all these other channels. So experimentally what they did was they blocked all the other channels they weren't interested in. Let's just deal with sodium channels, okay? So sodium channels, and we're going to block the potassium channels, we're going to block the calcium channels, and we're going to do this experiment, and we're going to measure from the resting membrane potential, RP as an abbreviation. Let's say it's minus 60 millivolts. We step it up, and we hold the membrane potential, and then we see what kind of current goes across. But we blocked all the other channels, so it's just going to be sodium current. And we find out that if you step it up, let's say, to minus 50, nothing really happens. You step it up to minus 40. Whoops, all of a sudden we got a big inward current down here. And now you go back, and now you step it back up, and let's go up higher. And let's go to minus 20 millivolts. And now it's way down here. And then we stop it, and we do the experiment again, and we go to 0 millivolts. So we're stepping it up from minus 60 to 0 millivolts. It's a 60 millivolt difference. We find out, oh my gosh, the current is way down here somewhere, inward current. And then we step it up to higher values, above 0. Let's go plus 5, plus 10, plus 20, plus 30, plus 40, plus 60. What did we come up with? Let's go all the way up, and we start going up, and we find out, what? It's decreasing more and more and more. And then finally we get to 63 millivolts. And there's zero current, right? Zero current. Because it's at the zero. Zero current. But now we're going to go above 63 millivolts. We're going to go to plus 70 millivolts. Way above this resting membrane potential, but above the equilibrium potential. And what do we get? We get a current that goes outward. All right, so now let's do our connect the dots. Okay, you get the idea? So what else is this? This is what they did experimentally to determine the equilibrium potential for that ion. And then you can backtrack and actually put the math in it, and it fits both ways. The experiment here is showing that at that equilibrium potential, no current is flowing when you went to that potential and opened up those channels. Because why? You're at the equilibrium at the potential for that concentration gradient. If you do that really quickly, there's no driving gradient because you have 63 millivolts across there, and the concentration gradient would generate that 63, but there's no net current, right? Because you're equal in the electrical potential to the concentration gradient potential that it would exist. So it's called an equilibrium potential. That's why it's called an equilibrium potential. Your text and many textbooks don't go through the original experiments, and it's kind of confusing. And then you just have to memorize things without understanding the concept. So understanding this concept is important to help you throughout, and then you understand the whole gamut. And like that email I just showed you, that text, that student with the following up, I said, what was it that really helped you? And she said, we never went over IV curves. I now understand that completely because you covered it in 350, okay? So let's do this not for a sodium channel. Let's do this for a potassium channel. Potassium's high on the inside, right? Low on the outside. So what's its equilibrium potential? If you worked it out with this equation and you flip these over, then potassium is going to be a negative value because it's going to be higher on the bottom than in the top. And you take that log and times it by that, it's going to be negative. All right. So anything that's higher on the inside compared to the outside on the positive charge like potassium, it's going to be negative. So it's down here somewhere. Let's say the equilibrium, we just call it E potassium. It might be at minus 70 millivolts. Okay. So if we do this experiment now, and how to do this experiment, it's a little challenging. What they do is they hold the membrane at these various steps, right? Open up a channel and go back to rest. Open up a channel and go back to the spot. They're voltage-sensitive channels, so you have to open up the channel by a voltage sense, you know, opening it up. but then bring it back, and then open it up again, and then bring it back, and find out what current flows through. Potassium channels are going to be closed. The voltage-gated potassium channels are going to be closed at rest. The key there was voltage-gated, right? But you got to open them. So you got to depolarize it and then bring it back to whatever value it is that you want to measure really quickly while the channel's still open. So it's a fast experiment. You open it up, bring it back to whatever value. If you want to go more negative, right, like negative 80 or negative 100, they're not going to open if you just go to a negative 100 from resting membrane potential because it's a depolarized state that opens it, okay? So you depolarize it, and you go to whatever value you want. And then you measure that current. So if you do that for potassium, you get something like this. All right. What this tells you, multiple things, is now you've measured the E potassium experimentally, and you find out it's like minus 70 millivolts. E potassium equals this, okay? Pretty neat. Well, why did it all of a sudden shoot up like this? Why did the sodium channel all of a sudden have this steep inward current? You now determined experimentally where the threshold is for those voltage-gated channels. You've now determined that at this value here, like minus 50 in this particular example, all of a sudden the voltage-gated channel started to open, right? And you have a big driving gradient. You just found out at this potential, the potassium channels were sensitive and they just opened and allowed potassium to go out because this is an outward current, right? So that's pretty neat experimentally to determine these. And you can really learn a lot by this. But the other point for your class lab next week, why is the resting membrane potential, like minus 60, not at E potassium? You know, so this is something to think about. Why is the resting membrane potential some other value? If the cell is at rest, it's kind of at equilibrium. It's not going anywhere, right? And this is what your lab experiment's all about. So we're going to go through a little bit of this as we go along. Okay. So this is really quite neat because you can understand how channels work, you can understand their voltage sensitivity, and you can understand what kind of properties are going on with this channel. So the problem with the Nernst equation, the one problem with this Nernst equation, is it doesn't tell you the permeability of the membrane. If the membrane is not permeable to the ion, it's not going to move across the cell, right? So it can't do anything. So what they came up with is we have to understand the permeability of the membranes. So some cells are more permeable to ions than others. So this is where they came up with the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, or the GHK equation, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz. And you hear people's names like Goldman, Hodgkin, and Katz, and you just want to put your hands together and like hum, because these are like the gods in the field, okay? Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz. So they came up with this idea that you got to understand the permeability because the Nernst equation is not doing it for us. So they came up with a way to look at all these ions, and they basically came up with the same idea, RT over F, and they can convert the LN. You know, you can convert this if you do the temperature to log if you want to. But basically, the point is they would look out the permeability for potassium, let's say, times the concentration of potassium on the outside, under the potassium concentration on the inside, plus maybe the sodium permeability, that's what P stands for, of the sodium and sodium on the outside. So the little O is for the outside, sodium on the inside, and they keep on going across for different ions. Like your lab manual has, they also show the P chloride, and it depends on the cell that you're looking at. In your lab next week, they actually taken away the chloride and not worrying about it. Now, because chloride's negative 1, gets confusing. Pay attention, this gets confusing. Because chloride was a negative 1, and we took out the Z right here, right? We took out the Z because we want to make this where we can work it out. So instead, you flip this over, I over outside, okay? So you flip that over, and that way you can keep working with this. Now, what if we were going to use it for calcium? P for calcium. P for calcium. Now, calcium is a plus 2 charge. Now, let's continue this down below. So this is here. So P calcium, P calcium. Now, calcium has what? A 2 charge, right? Oh, my gosh. But it's going to be out over in, just like for sodium potassium, because it's high on the outside. It's a plus charge. But it's a 2 plus charge, right? So to work this algebraically, if you ever see this in a textbook, you'll understand where it comes from. Because it's a 2 plus charge, and that 2 would be down here in that Z, you can put this up to the half power. Okay? So that's why that's written this way. What does this equation help us to understand? This helps to understand how the membrane functions at different levels of permeability. Okay? So this is called the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Let's have an example here where maybe it's not permeable to chloride and it's not permeable to calcium. Okay? So if P is 0, this drops out, right? Because P, 0 times this, that would drop out, this would drop out. If it's not permeable to calcium, this all drops out, right? And then we're back stuck with this. Most cells at rest have a little bit of sodium leakage. It's a little bit permeable to sodium. So this value is relatively low. But let's pretend for an example that the cell is not permeable to sodium. It's 0. So what happens here? This goes to 0. This goes to 0, right? This whole thing goes to 0. And now you have permeability over permeability, so you don't have to worry about that anymore. And what do you end up with? Back to the Nernst equation, right? For potassium ions. You get the point? Everybody understand this? Yes? This is important. This is like the major importance. If you could just, you know, anything you had today could purge everything else. If you just remember that, that would be fantastic, right? So you understand the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation is different than the Nernst equation because it accounts for multiple ions and the permeability of multiple ions. And when people have to have an open response question and they write this out, where do you lose points? You lose points because you forget this is divided by all the way across. This isn't this. It's not that. It's not plus, 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 plus. It's the whole thing over the bottom. So you might have to plug in some numbers that we will give you. Relatively straightforward. It's not going to be really hard, but just to make sure you understand the concepts here. Okay, any questions on the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation? Anybody? And if you're still in a daydream from waking up this morning, you can always email later on. Why? Go for it. No, in a sense, if you're not permeable to any of the other ions, you can use the Nernst equation for whatever ion you're working with.
Okay.
The point is that you need to consider the permeability of all the different ions to really get the true membrane potential. Because most cells aren't only driven by potassium. They have a little bit of leak of sodium. If you don't calculate it, then your equation doesn't fit the theoretical curve, which is important for next week. Right? Because you can have a theoretical curve doing what? You can actually vary. Let's just go to that next picture. You can vary the potassium on an external, and this is a semi, log, right? Well, the way they should work it out. Yes. And you see that, 100, right? So if you vary the external potassium, what happens to the membrane potential? Well, let's go back to this equation here. If you vary the potassium, we could alter this thing. Let's change this to, let's rewrite this. E potassium equals whatever this temperature is that we're going to work with. Let's do 0.58. Out over in. Okay. Out over in. We're going to keep in the same. What's in is about, let's just put it really low. Like maybe you could do whatever you do. We'll just say with the textbook, like 0.1 molar, for example. And you vary this outside concentration, okay? And that's 0.58. Okay? And then you measure this potential. If you measure that potential, while you vary the outside value, this is going to keep going up, right? It's going to keep coming more positive because this is higher on the inside than it is on the outside until you still keep adding it higher and higher and higher. So it starts off negative because it's low on the outside in normal cells, normal systems, but as you increase the concentration, your E
K, Nernst's equation, theoretical line, starts to go up, right? So you can plot that, and then you might be plotting that in your lab. But if you use the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation, you get something a little bit different. And this is your point, is that because the cell's a little permeable to sodium, you start to see the deviation. Now, a trick question that sometimes, I don't think they have to use it on standardized exams, but you see it in here sometimes. Why does this line deviate with very low concentrations on the outside? Well, if you take, and this goes back to our ion channels permeability, and but also selectivity, right? Why did some ion channels have different selectivity? If potassium concentration is so low on the outside, you have it so low, the potassium channel can actually conduct a little bit of sodium. And this is a deviation from just the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation or just the membrane. So another confusing point here. This is confusing. And I agree, it can be confusing. This is why I'm here, and not just reading your textbook. This is for passive properties of the membrane. These are not voltage-gated sodium potassium channels, okay? The difference is, what I went through with the IV curve was a lot with voltage-gated channels, right? Voltage-gated channels. You didn't see the linear line, right? You saw them going up at at these kind of lines, right? And this is not on Echo for any of you just sleeping today, and not an Echo, but these are written out, these overheads, right, is that these are voltage-gated channels. What we're talking about right here are leak channels. This is important. This is where it's confusing. 23 years of teaching this, right? Confusing. What I did up there was for voltage-gated channels that they'll open up at a certain voltage. These are leak channels that they're not just going right through, these ions aren't just going right through the membrane. They act like your figure. You're going to have one figure in your lab that the TAs are going to show you, PowerPoint, and they kind of show you a little squiggle with the sodium going through and the potassium just kind of leaking through the bilipid membrane. It's really channels, okay? They're called leak channels. So this tells you if you vary the potassium concentration externally, your membrane potential or the equilibrium potential for potassium is going to go up. But not only that, as you could calculate, the membrane, resting membrane potential of the cell will follow this. Why is that important? That tells you the cells at rest are leaky to potassium. Okay? It's not through voltage-gated channels. Leak channels. Remember what we said leak channels are? Keywords? Write on your arm, but erase it during test. Monovalent, cationic, channels, monovalent, sodium plus, potassium plus, cationic, right, plus charge, channels. So, as you vary the external potassium concentration, not only does your Nernst equation, E sodium, E potassium, go up, but your membrane potential of the cells will go up. This is the case for the majority of cells in your body. There are some exceptions, we'll get to that later, but the majority of cells of all animals will follow this, the majority of the cases, okay? Why is this important? Oh, let's think. Why is this important? Why is this important? You're going to be doing the experiment, I think, which your lab is next week, unless they change it again, is to vary the potassium concentration outside while you're measuring the resting membrane potential, and you're going to see it go up. Let's put this, why this is an important principle. A simple analogy. A construction worker is building the building that you're studying, right? Drops a cinder block on their leg, right? It doesn't break the skin, but it pushes that large muscle against the bone. What happens to that muscle? Breaks open, right? What's high inside of the cells compared to outside? What ion's high inside the cells compared to outside the cell? What's high inside the cells compared to outside the cells? Potassium. So that potassium now spills out around those cells. There are other cells that didn't get damaged by that cinder block hitting your bone and smashing. It's called a deep tissue injury, DTIs. Okay, deep tissue injury. Didn't break the skin, but smashed the muscle against the bone. Broke a lot of that muscle mass up, right? Now, all of a sudden, all that potassium just spilled out. what happens to the neighboring healthy cells now? What's going to happen to the resting membrane potential of those cells? It's going to depolarize, right? And depolarization of skeletal muscle causes contraction. So now all those other muscle cells are going to contract and start to fasciculate, basically kind of twitching. And they weren't even harmed. They didn't get hit by the cinder block. They didn't get injured. But what's even worse, that doesn't stay localized, does it? That potassium is going to go in your bloodstream, and where is it going to go? Next, your heart. And what's going to happen to your heart? You depolarize all that heart tissue, and your heart goes into some contraction, and it can't relax, and then what happens to you? And you can't, you know, you're going to have permanent relaxation. Okay, so, but not only that, that potassium is going to go to your brain. What's going to happen to all the neurons in your brain? All of those depolarize. So what do they worry about? Like in an ER, for example, somebody comes in with a massive tissue injury, they worry very much about arrhythmias. And what are they going to do? They're going to take an arterial stick, not a venous stick, an arterial stick. Who does the arterial sticks like in an ER? Anybody have an idea? And I really suggest you shadow multiple professional people if you're interested in allied health. Respiratory therapist, nurse, PA, PT, physicians, and you know everybody that's involved. The respiratory therapist is called. The respiratory therapist is trained to take an arterial stick. Even nurses aren't trained to do that. Take an arterial stick right into the artery, pull out blood, and they put it into a machine, and it measures potassium, sodium, bicarb, pH of it. And they see potassium high, they know they've got to bring it down fast, right? Because you're going to have arrhythmias, the brain's going to go into seizures and probably stop, and then that's it, you know, can't get it back, right? So how to bring potassium down really fast? What to do, what to do. Not only that, but what else is really high inside cells that we talked about? What's half of the weight inside the cell that we mentioned? Protein. So now all that protein comes out. What happens with all that protein? You think it stays right there? It gets in your blood, right? So it's going to get in your blood. It's called proteinemia. That blood with high protein, what's it going to do to your kidneys? Your glomerulus is like a little filter. When you make your coffee in the morning with coffee grains, right? You don't like all the coffee granules in the bottom of your coffee, if you do that. Your kidneys like that. So to block, what's going to happen, all that protein is going to go in there and block up the kidney filtration process. So now you're going to have acute renal failure. Whew, not good. So how to get this to happen? How to flush that out, right, really quickly? Well, they're going to put an IV in that person, 18-gauge needle, and just push that IV as much as they can to flush that protein out through the kidney so they can try to get it out before it clogs it all up. So they get the proteinemia out, so that can get so your kidneys will save, because if you have acute renal failure and it clogs up, the kidney will actually die, and that's a problem, right? So then you worry about the potassium, right? So the potassium, what's going to happen to all that potassium and the heart arrhythmia and the brain to go into a seizure and die? Well, they got to bring the potassium down quickly. So they do something that's kind of gross, but it saves people's lives. They take a resin called cacalate. Cacalate, this resin, will absorb potassium. Guess where they put it? Up your behind. Quickly, into your large intestine. But this teaches multiple principles here. Your large intestine is very vascular. It actually is the major resource for pulling out water to at the final end for your poop, right? And it can help with your water balance, osmolarity. But that resin will pull the potassium out of the blood, and then you get rid of that resin, and you do it again. And do it again, and bring that potassium back down so they don't die of an arrhythmia or the nervous system to shut down. Right, so it's kind of gross, but understanding now how important potassium is, we'll come back to that, about maintaining your resting membrane potential. Now you understand why you're doing this lab next week, too. It's so important to understand to keep potassium regulated very tightly in your blood and in your cells, because you could have all these problems, right? And you can measure this in your experiments. You will measure the resting membrane potential going up as your very external potassium. It will not go up, it will not change that much if you change sodium. Why not? If you change sodium on the outside and use the same experiment, but with sodium, why would you not see the membrane potential change as much as you would for potassium? Putting all of the things we just came together, our calcium, for that matter, our chloride, for that matter.
There's already high salt outside.
There's high salt outside, but what's the key point here about these leak channels and the Goldman-Hoskin-Katz equation and pulling it all together. Exactly. The cell, these leak channels are more permeable to potassium than they are for sodium or calcium, but only at low levels of potassium. When you don't have that competition with potassium, sodium can start to go through them. And that's why it deviates. So that's exactly the point. Is this. And so this is why the Goldman-Hoskin-Katz equation is important compared to the Nernst equation, because now you can look at other ions as well. Now, if you open up sodium channels, sodium will go through. Okay? So it's really important to understand these concepts. What would happen if you start to raise potassium? If you raise it slowly, the membrane potential will start to open. Now, what happens to voltage-gated channels? Like the voltage-gated sodium channel on the IV curves that we did, right? They might open, depending on how it depolarizes, and now all of a sudden, boom, sodium's going to go in and depolarize the cell even more. But how is it going to come back down to rest? So let's go through what you've remembered, and you've gone through 100 times probably, the shape of the action potential. Okay. We're going to measure it like they did in the squid axon. R at the frog neuromuscular junction. But let's think of the squid axon. RP. In this case, it might be around minus 90. You see these different values for the resting membrane potential in different books. And you think, what? What is this? Minus 90, minus 70, minus 60? What gives rise to the resting membrane potential? Open response type of question. What gives rise to the resting membrane potential? We just talked about permeability of potassium at rest, right? But also permeability of other ions that could be at rest, like a little bit of sodium, right? Leak channels in that concentration gradient drives your resting membrane potential, mostly, right? So whatever that concentration gradient is of potassium, what's going to maintain that potassium gradient? What maintains that gradient?
The sodium-potassium pump.
Sodium-potassium pump. Again, how important is it? If potassium is leaking, and sodium can leak in, and potassium can leak out, well, it has to reset all the time, right? So the pump's working all the time. But what if you depolarize it so like a normal action potential? Sodium goes in, potassium goes out. You've got to reset all that values. Sodium-potassium pump. Okay. So we're at minus 90. Let's start to depolarize the cell a little bit. Depolarize the cell a little bit. Okay, so because we're injecting some current. Okay, we're going to inject some current. This is I. We're going to inject some current, and we're measuring the potential. Okay? Membrane potential. And we injected some current, and we only get a little bit of rise. Okay? Let's inject a little more current. So it goes a little bit higher this time. And then all of a sudden, boom, we got this massive depolarization. Right? And then we only injected for a while, and then it started to come back down, and it hyperpolarized and came back like that. Woo! Let's figure out what on earth is inside of this potential that we measured in the squid axon. Let's dissect this shape that we got on the oscilloscope recording. Okay, one thing is you get this graded response right here, and then all of a sudden magic happened right there, right? Magic. What happened at this point right here? Voltage-gated sodium channels opened up. Voltage-gated sodium channels opened up, so now you know the sensitivity of the voltage-gated sodium channel. Back to our IV curves, right? You found out where this is, right here. And now they're all going to open up. Boom, they all open up. So sodium's going to rush in. And where is it going to? Where is this potential going to? Sodium channels opened up. What's the driving gradient? You're going to have to do these math problems. So watch out what happens here. What's the driving gradient for sodium going into that cell? What's it trying to go to? What's driving it? High sodium on the outside, low sodium on the inside. It wants to balance. How could we determine what that balance is? What's the equation? Nernst equation for sodium, right? For sodium. And what did we figure it out? Plus 68 in that example that we did. It wants to go up to plus 68. It wants to go to the equilibrium potential. So it's shooting up to the equilibrium potential as fast as it can, right? It wants to go there. The sodium channels are open. We just opened them. Why does it not go to 68? Why does it only go to, say, like plus 10 in this case? What's the situation? It's driving it to go to the E sodium. It wants to go to E sodium because that's the equilibrium for sodium. Because we started off at minus 90, and if it's at plus 68, what's the driving gradient there? This is what you see on the old tests if you haven't started looking yet. What's the driving gradient for sodium at the time we open it? Well, wherever that is, to the E sodium. So think about this. If this was minus 90, and let's say this opens up at minus 80, what's the driving gradient? Minus 80 to 0, and then to 68. So 80 and 68, right? 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 148 millivolt driving gradient for sodium. Wow, that's a big driving gradient for sodium to rush into the cell. But why does it not go to E sodium? You know the answer already because you studied the action potential. What's the answer? What happens? What brings that potential back down?
Potassium.
There's another threshold for potassium. Now you understand why we did this IV curve. It wasn't just a tangent. The IV curve shows us for voltage-gated potassium channels at some value over here, plus value, we started to open up the voltage-gated potassium channels. So these are opening now. There's another threshold. These are the potassium channels that are opening up. And now, where was the driving gradient when we were at, let's say for the squid, and I didn't give you everything, let's say that E potassium in this example is at a minus 100, okay? What's the driving gradient at the resting membrane potential for potassium? If we're at the resting membrane potential, what's the driving gradient for potassium? Minus 90 to 100 is 10 millivolts, right? So it's not a very big driving gradient right here. But if we're up here, let's say this is like minus 20, or maybe even higher, maybe, you know, something. If we're up here, what's the driving gradient now for potassium? Well, minus 20 to 100. Now it's like 80 millivolts, right? So if you open up the potassium channels at rest, these are voltage-gated. See the confusion? Leak channels versus voltage-gated channels. We're talking about voltage-gated channels here. If you open up the voltage-gated channels, the driving gradient is very large when you depolarize the cell. And it's counteracting the sodium that's going in. So the reason is that why you do not reach E sodium, twofold. One, you're opening up voltage-gated potassium channels, and that's counteracting that. As you get closer to the E sodium, your driving gradient goes down for sodium, right? Because you're getting closer to the E sodium, so your driving gradient's less. And if that potassium opened up voltage-gated potassium channels, the potassium wants to go out and counteract the sodium going in, but there's something very unusual that happens to voltage-gated sodium channels. What is it that we're looking for? You remember this in 152. What happens to voltage-gated sodium channels? After they open, let's have a channel that's closed. They sense the voltage. They open up. Sodium's going to rush in. But think of that protein. It changes its conformation, and it goes into an inactive state. And it's a closed state. It's inactivated. It closes after it opens. So it opens for a short period of time, and then it goes into an inactive state. Okay, the key word there is inactive. Inactive state. So if they open, and then after they open, they go into an inactive state, what happens? No more sodium going through, right? And they close. But it's not just closed. It's an inactive closed state. Okay, so now the sodium channel is closed, but what channel opened? Potassium, right? So now what's going to happen to the potential? Well, it wants to go back to where? The E potassium. Let's draw that up there. Sorry. The E potassium. It wants to go to E potassium. So now it goes to E potassium. And then what happens when it goes back down to E potassium? What opened the voltage-gated potassium channels to initiate it? What opened them? Magic. The voltage, right? The voltage across the membrane. But if we're not at that voltage anymore, what happens to the voltage-gated potassium channels? If we're not at this voltage anymore, what's going to happen to them? They're not open. They start to close. And then what's working all the time? All the time. What's working in the cells all the time? Taking the most ATP out of you all the time. The sodium-potassium pump. And if the potassium channels are closing now because they're not open, we go back to the resting membrane potential. So you see how this is very important to understand these driving gradients. So do understand to calculate a driving gradient from whatever potential to the E sodium or E potassium. Do understand that why we don't go to the peak of the action potential doesn't go to E sodium. Two reasons. You opened up voltage-gated potassium channels and inactivated sodium channels. What happened here? Why did it go below the resting membrane potential? What does that tell you? That the E potassium is lower than the resting membrane potential. What if you showed a potential like this and it went right back to resting membrane potential? What might you anticipate here? What would you draw? What kind of conclusions, based on the information you have so far, what would you postulate? The potassium channel is closed. Exactly. And so to put those in words is that the equilibrium potential is close to the resting membrane potential. And so it went to the E potassium, and it just happened to be very close to the resting membrane potential, maybe right at it. So it didn't have to have that hyperpolarization. Now go to any med physiology book, human physiology, med physiology textbook, and they will show you this kind of action potential up here, and they make you believe that every cell is this way. This is the squid axon. Most cells do not show a hyperpolarization. Most cells do not show a hyperpolarization below the resting membrane potential. They will generally go back to the resting membrane potential. They might go a little bit more negative, but not that much. So the majority of cells show like this. Okay? So don't be deceived by, and nobody got the $100 yet. This is why I make this point, right? So a lot of inference by things, but it goes back to the original work of the squid. Now, we just went through some of that, and let's go back to that bet. What happens at the neuromuscular junction in the presynaptic motor nerve terminal? What's the shape of the action potential there? Do you think the shape of the action potential is the same as it is along the axon? And some of this we haven't covered yet. But we do have to understand at the nerve terminal, not just voltage-gated sodium channels. So you have a little V under the sodium, or the potassium, a little V underneath it. That means they're voltage-gated, right? But you have something unique at the nerve terminal where transmitter is going to be released. You have calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels. And that's key that we're going to talk about later on, that calcium is really key at the nerve terminal for transmitter release. Okay? So now you have voltage-gated calcium channels. All right. So the shape of the action potential up here might be like that, but what's the shape of the action potential at the nerve terminal? What would you predict the shape would be? If calcium might be what? 1 times 10 to the minus 6 molar on the inside, and maybe, let's just say, for example's sake, 1 millimolar or 1 times 10 to the minus 3 molar on the outside. That's a pretty big gradient, right? Really big gradient. Now just think in your mind. Visualize it. What would be the E calcium? Is it going to be negative or positive? High calcium on the outside, like sodium. Low calcium on the inside, like sodium. What was the E sodium? Plus 68. Compared to E potassium. So what do you think the calcium is going to be? Some positive value, but this is a much larger driving gradient, right? So it's even higher. It might be at plus 120. It depends on the cell and the conditions. But now you have a very high, plus 120 millivolts for the E calcium. Whoa! And they're going to be voltage gated. So as the action potential comes down here, and you open up these, and their threshold, if we did an IV curve on top of this, for calcium, you would see something like this. You know, way over here, at a plus 120, it's going to reverse. But you see that it opened up, right? It opened up. So now, what's the shape of the action potential at the nerve terminal? What would you anticipate? Is it going to be narrower? Is it going to be wider? Is the peak amplitude going to change? What's going to be the differences? Should we just leave this for an open response question, or should we go through it? Hint, hint. Okay. I'm afraid that you'll stress out and like throw oranges at me during the test if I did that to you. Okay, so let's go work through this. If voltage-gated calcium channels opened up here and voltage-gated potassium channels opened up here and voltage-gated sodium channels opened up here, let's say, okay, so that was just for the axon, but now we have this new channel that's here and it opens up and the driving gradient's really strong for calcium and it doesn't have as fast an activation like the sodium channel, we might actually get a larger peak, right? Because now calcium ion's going inside the cell. And they don't show that inactivation like the voltage-gated sodium channel. So what might you anticipate the duration of this is? Maybe longer, wider, before it comes back down and the potassium takes over. But now as you come back down, if you have a lot of this voltage-gated potassium channels and it starts to overdo the calcium, then the potassium takes over and you're past the opening of the calcium channel voltage, so they start to close. And potassium is slow to close, so then you have a wider and a higher amplitude action potential. Wouldn't that be neat if they could measure that inside of a mammalian neuromuscular junction at the nerve terminal? But they can't. But you have done this in squid, and you have done this in crustacean preparation, so this is where this kind of information comes from. Okay, so really important to understand these concepts. Is anybody confused on anything that we just covered? Yes?
Can you repeat why it was
because calcium is going in, and it went to a much higher level, and calcium doesn't inactivate like the voltage-gated sodium channels, so it's going to stay, and calcium is going to keep coming in a little bit longer and longer and longer until the potassium can kind of take over. Okay, and this is important when we get to the neuroendocrine part in the pituitary, for example. If you measure the action potential in the pituitary gland, which is a neuroendocrine organ, there's a lot of voltage-gated calcium channels there, and the action potential is wider. Why? Because it wants more calcium to come in to cause the vesicles to fuse and release endocrine responses, right? So you see different shapes of action potentials primarily in neuroendocrine nerve terminals because they want a lot of calcium in there to have these vesicles fuse to release hormones. Okay. All right, so whew. We went through all this. Super cool. What maintains all this? Again, the sodium-potassium pump. So cool. Very cool. Let's go on a divergence, for example. Divergence. Sodium-potassium, ATPase is so cool, right? The pump, because you can go to that and you can look up some really neat information about the sodium-potassium pump. But look at this. This is really cool. I just found this last night. The number of expressed sodium-potassium pumps differs by cell type, but is generally between, 80,000 and 30 million? 30 million? Wow. The number of proteins, the number of pumps in a cell, 30 million? Wow. 30 million. And your cells made that, right? That's a protein. It had to be made, right? Messenger RNA. What happens if you quit making those? Problem, right? What if we block the pump? What if we block the pump? What if you were out in the wilderness, out in India, I think it's out in India somewhere, the Middle East, they have this little plant. And you were like, I'm just going to make tea with that plant. Or, it's got little seeds. Maybe I'll just eat those little seeds because it's like sunflower seeds or something. I'll just eat them. Right? So you just grind them up, make a little flour out of it, you know. And, wow, I got some, you know, starchy stuff here. And I'm just going to make some bread out of this. Well, it'll be the last time to make that bread. Because inside of these plants and certain seeds, there's a drug that the plant makes called wabang. Wabang blocks the voltage-gated sodium channels. It was postulated a long time ago, and you can look this up, it's on Wikipedia too, when the Portuguese went into Africa a long time ago, actually the African tribes had this poison on their arrows. It's a different type of poison than you're thinking of South America and the other poison down there, Karari. This, they would actually trait from the plants that they had, and they would shoot it at the arrow. So you get a little arrow tip, or you could take the arrow out, but then they would die later on. So they found out what this was. They finally figured out what this poison was. They took it to the labs and then worked on it and found out it was wabang. And what happened with many of these people that died from that poison arrow stuff was actually they had cardiac problems. But then they actually figured out that this could be used for treatment. Too. So they actually use it for treatment. It's like digitalis. You probably heard of digitalis. It's like it works pretty much the same way. So it's really quite interesting. And there's even an animal, I think it's maybe on this page, I don't know. Maybe you covered it in ecology. I don't know what they cover in ecology these days. Wabang, here it is, wabang. You can read this up, it's really cool. This drug from that plant, the little seeds. This has it. This little rat, it doesn't eat it, but it chews it up and puts it on its coat, on its hair. So if something bites it, it will get this wabang, and then it will have a problem and won't be able to finish off its meal. Isn't that pretty cool? But it doesn't eat it itself. That's pretty neat. So that's wabang. Now, let's think about something else. For example, what was this one about? Oh, that was the journal articles. And we'll come to the next one in a second. All right. What happens if we took a cell, your experiment next week, you stab an intracellular electrode in the resting membrane potential, you got resting membrane potential, minus 60. Let's do this experiment. Let's put wabane on the prep. What would happen to your resting membrane potential if you put wabane on the prep? The sodium potassium pump is blocked. Well, if potassium leaks out, potassium would be higher on the outside now. So you're right on the right track, but the e-potassium would start to go up because it's getting higher on the outside and lower on the inside. So then that equation starts to become less negative, more positive. Sodium's going into the cell, so it becomes not as minus 68, but it's going to start to drop because it's building up on the inside. But now your resting membrane potential is going to start to go up. Up, 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 up. Depolarizing the cells. It's no different than an experiment I told you about where you poison the mitochondria. Remember I told you about that? You poison the mitochondria with the pH electrode and the pH sitting up there. If you poison the mitochondria with an azide, you can't make the ATP, can't finish the pump, can't make the pump work because there's no ATP. So what happens to your cells? They depolarize. So what happens if you depolarize cells slowly? Depolarize them slowly, slowly, slowly. And then you wanted to make an action potential. This is a really interesting experiment. Because if you depolarize cells slowly, and let's say you stimulate like this, and you, a normal cell kind of comes up here, and maybe it's going to make that action potential, right? But now, if you depolarize slowly with wabane, and you depolarize slowly and slowly and slowly, it can go above that threshold for activating the voltage-gated sodium channels. Because why? A few of those voltage-gated sodium channels aren't always just sensitive right at that threshold. A few will start to open. And what happens after they open? They inactivate. And then you open up a few more, and they inactivate. And you open up a few more, and they inactivate. So what you've done is you've changed the threshold of activating the voltage-gated sodium channels because you're inactivating a little bit at a time. They open, they inactivate, open, inactivate. So now you've changed the whole excitation of the nervous system, our heart action potentials. Very important, right? And then if you keep depolarizing the cell anyways, and you keep depolarizing, it goes to zero, the membrane loses its potential, the driving gradient for all the other ions are messed up, and you die. Okay? So that's kind of interesting to think about. So really important, these things. What can I end on this? Okay. We went through the action potential. I don't need to go through all that again because we just talked about it. This figure is really important. But why is it when you get the second stimulus, like right here, you don't get a second action potential? You know the answer. What is it? Because the voltage-gated sodium channels, right? Sodium channels are still inactivated. And this is referred to as absolute refractory period. If you stimulate a little bit later, some of the sodium channels came back to activation, and you can get a little abortive action potential. And you wait later, and now you finally got the full thing. So this is relative to refractory period. Refractory period is all to do with the voltage-gated sodium channel inactivation. Okay? So what's really interesting is if you depolarize slowly for a long period of time and you kept them up, you can't get the cells to be activated again because it requires a cell to come back to a low level to remove the inactivation. So if you stay depolarized, you're not going to be able to open those voltage-gated sodium channels. You have to come bring the membrane back down for a certain period of time before they're activated again. Okay, so that's all that kind of good stuff. And you can think about this, what we just talked about in the squid, great stuff, and the shape of the action potential. And this is basically decreasing the sodium on the outside of the prep. What would you expect? The action potential would be smaller and smaller and smaller, right? You put it back to the normal sodium, and boom, you get it back again. So that just shows you what was there. Okay, so we have some fun little thing to go through, and then we'll cover this up next week. But you have enough now for your lab. Well, let's go end on some fun things. Okay, so this is really fun. I don't know if you've ever seen this, about a veterinarian and this gal. Oh, shoot. I need this. TED Talks. Anybody ever watch TED Talks? They are fantastic, right? So she's a cardiologist at UCLA.
Cardiac imaging techniques.
Anybody ever see this before? Super cool.
From a veterinarian at the Los Angeles Zoo. An elderly female chimpanzee had woken up with a facial droop, and the veterinarians were worried that she had a stroke. They asked if I'd come to the zoo and image the animal's heart to look for a possible cardiac cause. Now, to be clear, North American zoos are staffed by highly qualified, board-certified veterinarians who take outstanding care of their animal patients. But occasionally, they do reach in to the human medical community, particularly for subspecialty consultation, and I was one of the lucky physicians who was invited in to help. I had a chance to rule out a stroke in this chimpanzee and make sure that this gorilla didn't have a torn aorta. Evaluate this macaw for a heart murmur. Make sure that this California sea lion's pericardium wasn't inflamed. And in this picture, I'm listening to the heart of a lion after a life-saving collaborative procedure with veterinarians and physicians where we drained 700 cc's of fluid from the sac in which this lion's heart was contained. And this procedure, which I have done on many human patients, was identical with the exception of that paw and that tail. Now, most of the time, I was working at UCLA Medical Center with physicians discussing symptoms and diagnoses and treatments for my human patients. But some of the time, I was working at the Los Angeles Zoo with veterinarians discussing symptoms and diagnoses and treatments for their animal patients. And occasionally, on the very same day, I went on rounds at UCLA Medical Center and at the Los Angeles Zoo. And here's what started coming into very clear focus for me. Physicians and veterinarians were essentially taking care of the same disorders in their animal and human patients. Congestive heart failure, brain tumors, leukemia, diabetes, arthritis.
I'm just going to skip over to this.
Right, I'm going to have to air some dirty laundry. Some physicians can be real snobs about doctors who are not MDs. I'm talking about dentists and optometrists and psychologists, but maybe especially animal doctors. Of course, most physicians don't realize that it is harder to get into vet school these days than medical school. And that when we go to medical school, we learn everything there is to know about one species, Homo sapiens. But veterinarians need to learn about health and disease in mammals, amphibians, reptiles, fish, and birds.
And I leave that off there to think about comparative physiology. In veterinary school, like in UC Davis, which is a really good veterinary school, they require, just for your application, I think it used to be 700 hours, I think it's now 900 hours of shadowing a veterinarian before you even apply. Many veterinarians are vet techs, I mean, when they apply. But it's also a great profession for pre-physician students as well. become a vet tech, and you will be doing surgeries. You'll be doing pharmacology. You'll be treating, and you're also dealing with people, right? And their pets, which usually they take better care of their pets than they do their own children. So, you know, you kind of think about this might be a good way to get into the medical profession if you're interested in that, or you might think of other things too, but it really gives you hands-on training and aspects. Veterinary school is very hard to get into. Has a high threshold. Just to let you know, I think a few years ago we had two students that wanted to go to med school, that wanted to go to PA school. Actually, it was PA school. They didn't get into PA school. And you think, oh, well, they should have got into PA school. They had good grades and everything. They had A's and everything. They didn't get into PA school. They both applied to PA school. They didn't get in. Why not? They had like 4.0s in, you know, biology majors. And they didn't get in. They turned around. They both applied to med school. They both got into med school. Different programs have different thresholds or what they're looking for, right, in people. So you think about the experiences, and they didn't have a lot of shadowing experience. But PAs, they really want you to have a good, friendly atmosphere. They want you to understand the public, and probably a good major for that is really psychology, right? Working with the public. So just think about these things for your own profession. That's what I'm trying to get you going. Okay? A good deal. Good luck studying. Hopefully you won't freeze to death. This.